I came up here to introduce our speaker this morning. I have never heard of it. They say he's a good AA. They tell me he is. And if he is a good AA, he's got a good message for you and for me. And I ask you now to relax and enjoy the message that Art Graham of Richmond V has for you. Chamber of Commerce asked that I not disclose there. Well, kids, you know, Art Graham.
You're looking at one Southern Baptist preacher who has reached the point where he's sort of at a loss for words. Friday night, 25%. Saturday morning, another 25%. Saturday afternoon, another 25%. Last night, another 25%. That adds up to 100% of a wonderful convention. Now just what the hell can I add? I called the airport last night, desperately hoping that I might be able to catch a late flight out, but they told me there wasn't any available. And I'm too old to thumb. And so I'm here. And the execution was set for 10 a.m. We're running 20 minutes late, which means that I've got a reprieve. By God's grace, we're going to have a meeting. I'm glad that you came this morning. I tell you, you know, I got a friend up in North Carolina, Dave C. He's known to a great many of you. One time old Dave said to me, Art, he said, don't ever get known as a Sunday morning speaker. And I've tried to avoid that. And so when Clarence called me Wednesday night, he said, Art, you still coming to my convention? Because we'd been planning to come down anyway. And I said, yeah, Clarence, I'm coming down there. And he said, well, how'd you like to come free? And I said to myself, uh-oh. I said, when, Clarence? He said, Sunday morning. And, you know, I had an opportunity right then to get sick and to tell him that I just couldn't do it. But I wouldn't have done that for the world, man. Even in this last cleanup spot where you're trying to polish a jewel that has already been perfectly polished, I wouldn't pass up the opportunity for all the tea in China. I'm Art Graham, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. So what? Some people I know got TB. Some people I know have diabetes. Some people I know suffer from hangnails. Some people I know got the gout. Some people I know got a whole list of other kinds of illnesses of one sort or another. Me, I got alcoholism. And I know that it's a progressive illness. But I also know that since I came into the fellowship of this program, I've been embarked on a progressive program of recovery. And I know that I'd rather spend the rest of my life getting better than to spend the rest of my life getting sicker. I'm an alcoholic. So what? I have reached the point where I know that all of life is not lived in an AA meeting. I've reached a point where I know that I cannot always be on that mountaintop of experience that comes with such meetings as we had last night. I've reached a point where I know that a great deal of my serious living has to take place in the valleys. I've reached a point where I'm supremely aware of the fact that I'm an alcoholic trying to live in a non-alcoholic world. And in order to do this, I've got to come to grips with living in a non-alcoholic world. Bob read the purpose of AE a while ago. And in a very broad sense, the purpose of AA is to help me and you to recover from our illness. It is to help me to arrest this illness so that I, as an alcoholic, can learn to function and to function reasonably well and with a degree of comfort in a non-alcoholic society. Our purpose says that AA is a fellowship of men and women. Thank God for that. Thank God that it is a fellowship, because you know the world is filled today with organizations, societies, associations, clubs, classes, groups, mobs, protest gatherings, and other concerned individuals. But there aren't very many fellowships around. Thank God that AA is a fellowship of men and women. The fact that AA is a fellowship is important to us in AA for many reasons, and sometimes we talk about some of them. It's important to us for some reasons that we don't talk about too often, and I'd like to just mention in passing two or three of these reasons that are important, but that we don't spend a whole lot of time talking about. The fact that AA is a fellowship is important to us in AA because it reminds us that we are not banded together as a group in a medical society. Therefore, it suggests to us that since as a group we are not medical doctors, we have no business trying to tell the medical profession how to run their program. Now, don't misunderstand me. If they ask for our experience, we'll gladly share it. But we have no business trying to tell them how to do it, because they're not alcoholics. And the only way that we know how to tell them how to do it is to tell them the AA way of doing it. And they can't do it the AA way. They're trying to learn, and I, for one, want to give them the benefit of every doubt and at the same time give them every support that I possibly can. The fact that we are a fellowship of men and women reminds us also that we are not an association of theologians, and that therefore we have no business being out in religious fields for any great length of time as a group of AA people. As individuals, of course, we have some business being in religion, but AA as such has no business in the field of religion. The fact that AA is a fellowship of men and women reminds us also that as a group we're not psychiatrists. We don't know that much about behavioral attitudes and patterns. And we would do well to pause for a moment before we disparage and downgrade the psychiatrists and the psychologists that many of us turn to for enough help to get here. Let's give them their due. The fact that AA is a fellowship of men and women also reminds us that neither collectively nor as individuals are we God. And therefore we have no right to insist that every alcoholic can work this program, because every alcoholic has not. Every alcoholic does not, and every alcoholic never will work the program of AA. No, we are not here to play God. We are here to be a fellowship of men and women who share their experience and their strength and their hope with each other. The fact that AA is a fellowship is important to us in AA in a more positive sense than those I've mentioned to you. It's important to us because it reminds us that we belong to each other. And that's the real meaning of the word fellowship, a mutual belonging, a belonging to one another. Not in the sense that we own each other, not in the sense that I have the right to tell you what to do, or that you have the right to tell me what to do, but we belong to each other through the mutual sharing of the things that we've mentioned, our strength and our hope and our experience. This means that we share each other's burdens, we share each other's griefs, we share each other's disappointments, we share each other's failures, because all these are a part of the experience of every one of us. It means that we share each other's good fortune. It means that we share each other's growth, achievement, joy, faith, because all these are a part of our strength. It means that we share each other's dreams. It means that we share each other's aspirations. It means that we share each other's yearnings and longings and prayers, because all these are a part of our hope. As important as AA is to those of us who are in the fellowship already, as important as the fellowship is to those of us who are members, it is also of equal importance to the alcoholic who is still suffering. The drinking alcoholic now is neither alive nor dead. Then he's neither hot or cold. He's a man or woman without roots, without meaning in his life, without purpose, without direction. He's a man or woman who is seeking anxiously to find something that he can hold on to that will give a little stability to his life. He's a lukewarm organism who longs to know who he is as a person. When I came to AA, I was lost. I didn't know who I was. I knew my name sometimes. I wasn't always sure of that. But I didn't know who I was as a human being. I didn't know who I was who had the ability to react sometimes in a most violent way to something that was of no great significance. I didn't know who I was as a person who could cry at the drop of a hat when there was nothing to cry about. I didn't know who I was as a person who could feel a sense of resentment when there was really nothing to be resentful about. I didn't know who I was as a person who could feel the burden of guilt so heavily that I wanted to crawl into a hole and not ever come back out again. The still suffering alcoholic. A man or a woman without roots, without meaning in his life, without purpose, without direction, who wants to know who he is so that he can determine who he can become. I agree with Paul about the futility of analysis paralysis. And yet at the same time, for me, I need to recognize who the old man is before I can have any possibility of determining who the new man might become through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In AA, we talk about growing along spiritual lines. And you know that to grow means to move from where you are to some place further down the line. It means to make progress. Well, there is no way to make this move from where we now are to where we would like to be. There is no way to become that new person that we want to become unless we first know where we are now and who we are now, so that we can determine who we want to become and what direction we have to take in order to reach that particular place. Thus, to the still suffering alcoholic, the fact that AA is a fellowship of men and women, not a society or a club or an organization or an association, but a fellowship of men and women who belong to each other, this fact offers to him potentially the very gift of life itself. As a suffering alcoholic, looking back from, you know, this better vision of hindsight, as a suffering alcoholic, I recognize the fact that I was a prisoner of many attitudes, many emotions, many feelings. And we all know that a good builder can take the same building materials and build either a prison or a bridge. In my act of alcoholism, I took the building materials that God gave me and I built prisons instead of bridges. For the fact that I built prisons, I'm responsible, ultimately. For the fact that now in my recovery I'm trying to build bridges, I am also ultimately responsible through God's grace and with your help. For instance, when I was an active alcoholic, I built a prison of fear. I was afraid of people. I was afraid that they wanted more from me than I could give. I was afraid that they asked more than I could supply. I was afraid that I was inadequate to meet the demands that they were continually placing on me. Shy, withdrawn, yes, but most of all, fearful that somehow or another I wasn't good enough, that somehow or another I didn't quite measure up to the standards that they had set for me. Thank God, after some time in AA, I realized that other people don't set my standards. That I, in my relationship with my God, set my standards. And nobody else can do it for me. I built a prison of fear, the fear of people, the fear also of failure. When I was a kid, I lived with my grandfather in the mountains of Virginia, who was a Methodist minister of the old school, one of the fundamentalists, who believed that, man, you know, this business of drinking is it's morally evil. It's wrong. You're not supposed to do it. He also believed that children should learn early to be number one, even in school. And when I went to school as a child living with my grandfather, he expected me to get 100 on every test for any course that I had. And when I came home with a 95 on a spelling test where I could have gotten 100, he would say to me, "That's pretty good, Pat." Pat's my middle name. He'd say, "That's pretty good, Pat, but it's not good enough." And I'd get a whipping because I didn't make 100. One day on my way to school, I had a new football I just received from Sears Roebuck, and I was walking down the road, and I was throwing this football up in the air and letting it come into my shoulder here and catch it, you know, and it missed and rolled out in the middle of the road, and I had to walk about 2 miles to school. And boy, the busing situation wasn't quite as terrific as it is now. I had to walk about these 2 miles to school, though, and walking down this old country road, and I was so engrossed in catching my football, you know, that I wasn't aware of the fact that behind me coming down the road was a school bus. And so when I dropped the ball, I went out into the road to pick it up. And just as I bent down to pick it up, the school bus hit me in the back and knocked me down. I wasn't badly injured. I was scared, you know, scared. The driver was so scared that he came out the window instead of come out the door. But after a few minutes of having received consolations and condolences and comfort and all this sort of thing from the driver and the teacher and assembled friends, I went on to school. When I came home from school that afternoon, my grandfather had heard about it. And he met me at the door, and he said, "What happened?" And I told him. And he told me, well, you had no business playing with that ball as you walked to school. And he whipped me. I was afraid to fail. I was a prisoner of the fear of failure. But then, you know, I learned too that I was a prisoner of the fear of success. Because the more that I measured up to the standards that were set, the more successful I was in them, the higher the standards became. And so I was sort of afraid to succeed because I knew that this would mean more responsibility. More would be expected. And I didn't see how in the world I could meet those standards. So I was a prisoner of the fear of people, a prisoner of the fear of failure, a prisoner of the fear of success. In my active alcoholism, I built this prison. Now, in my continuing recovery through the fellowship of AA, I'm trying to build a bridge. I'm trying to build a bridge of faith that will span the prison of fear. I'm trying to build a bridge of faith in my God, a bridge of faith in you, and a bridge of faith in my own self. In my act of alcoholism, I built a prison of loneliness. Nobody hurt like I did. Nobody understood me. Nobody could possibly understand the depth of my feelings of insecurity. And if they knew about all the feelings I had going on inside me, nobody could possibly like me or allow me to stay very long in their presence. And in my prison of loneliness that I built for myself, there was a solitary cell. You know, every jail has to have a solitary cell. And mine was marked self-pity. And I spent lots of time in solitary confinement in my prison, in this little cell of self-pity, feeling sorry because nothing seemed to be right, feeling sorry for myself because everybody seemed to be against me and nobody was for me. In my recovery program through this fellowship, I'm trying to build a bridge of friendship to replace the loneliness, a bridge of acceptance of the fact that God accepts me just the way I am. One of the biggest hang-ups I had as an active alcoholic was the belief that neither God nor any person could accept me unless I reached certain standards. Now through this program, I'm trying to build the bridge of acceptance of the fact that God accepts me just the way I am, with my defects of character, with my faults, with whatever weaknesses I have, and with whatever strengths that I may have. In my act of alcoholism, I built a prison of pride. I don't need you, God. I don't need you, wife. I don't need you, friend. I don't need you, employer. World, get off my back. I don't need you. A prison of pride. Through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm now trying to build a bridge of gratitude. Thank you, God, for being. What kind of world would it be without him? Thank you, God, for just being. Thank you, wife, for staying with me. For it wasn't easy for her. I made life pretty miserable for her on more than one occasion. And there were times when she wanted to leave desperately. And there were times when she almost left. But she didn't. And I thank her now for being my wife, for being one who stayed with me through it all. Thank you, friend, for walking with me through a lot of lonely times. Thank you, friend, for caring about me when I wasn't very friendly myself. Thank you, friend, for sort of reading my mind and knowing when I needed to hear words and when I needed to simply sit in silence with you. Thank you, employer, for some recognition of whatever capacities and abilities that I have. Thank you, world, for being a place where God and wife and friend and employer and I could come together in some sort of meaningful relationship that would allow the whole business of breathing in and breathing out to become a beautiful experience of real living. In my act of alcoholism, I built a prison of brokenness. My life was shattered. It was fragmented. I felt separated from God. I felt separated from other people. And I felt separated from myself. I felt as if this God that I had been taught about at the knees of this Methodist grandfather lived somewhere out yonder in outer space, and he was not available to me, and therefore we were in two separate worlds. I felt separated from him. I felt that people, other people, had no part in me, and therefore we walked separate paths. And I felt that I must be at least three distinct individuals in my own right. There were times when I'd been drinking for a while and I'd come home and stretch out on the couch in the living room. And I was one of those drinkers who didn't shave and didn't bathe and didn't use underarm deodorant and didn't change my socks either. And I'd stretch out on the couch and have my old shoes on and, hadn't bathed or shaved. And my wife would come through the room and she'd say something like, "It's a particular TV show I'd like to see." And she'd turn it on. And I'd go into a rage. "Why do you have to look at that junk? I want to see something that I like." "Who do you think you are, anyhow?" She saw this picture of me. But then while I was lying there on the couch, if there was a knock on the door and a neighbor from next door or from down the street dropped by, I rolled off the couch, and tried to straighten that old dirty shirt the best I could, and I walked to the door and I turned the knob and I opened it and I put on the best smile that I could muster. "Hi, John. Hello, Murray. Come on in. Oh, it's nice to see you. Come on and have a seat." And I tried to be the beautiful host. "You want to watch television? Care for a drink? Want to just sit around and chat? Want to just have a nice, friendly, sociable evening together?" They saw another side of me, another picture of me. And as they walked home, I sort of pictured in my mind what Mary was saying to John. "John, why ain't you like him? So nice." But then in the stillness of the night, I had another picture of myself. Picture of a guy who was locked up in a cage. A man I wanted desperately out of that cage, but whom somehow or other I couldn't get out. The real me. Would you stand up, the real Art? And the real Art couldn't stand up. The real Art couldn't get out of his prison. The real Art couldn't get out of his cage of brokenness. In my act of alcoholism, I built a prison of brokenness. In my recovery program through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm trying to build a bridge of wholeness. Please don't confuse wholeness with perfection. Sometimes we talk about being perfect. And when we talk about being perfect, we're always talking about being a perfectly morally good person, and we can't do it. We are all incapable of it, and yet it is possible for each of us to become a whole person. That's what I'm striving for. to become a whole person, integrated with God, integrated with you, and integrated within myself. This is what wholeness really is. In my act of alcoholism, I built a prison of non-forgiveness. I don't know whether you ever had that sort of experience or not. When somebody did you wrong, even if you just thought they did you wrong, you sort of smiled to yourself maybe and said, well, you're bigger than I am. I can't get even with you right now, but my day will come. And I used to walk around waiting for the dark nights, hoping that in the dark night I'd see that guy who'd done me wrong so I could get even with him. I found it awfully hard to forgive a real or fancied wrong. I built a prison of non-forgiveness. In my recovery program through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm trying to build a bridge that reaches toward God's forgiving grace, because I'm fully aware that until I receive God's forgiveness for me, I cannot forgive myself. And if I can't forgive myself, if I haven't received God's forgiveness for me, I don't have any forgiveness to give you. You can't give away what you don't have. So I'm trying to build a bridge of forgiveness. In my act of alcoholism, I built a prison of the inability to love. I don't mean the inability to get in heat. But the inability to love, and there's a difference. The inability to share my inward self with somebody else. The inability to share my fears. The inability to share my worries. The inability to share my concerns. The inability to share my dreams. The inability to share with somebody else, even someone close to me, the things that make up normal everyday living. And I've discovered that for myself, the reason why I built this prison was to protect me. You see, there's one thing about prisons. They're secure places. And when you're in a prison, you're protected from outside forces. And when I built a prison of the inability to love, I was protecting myself from the possibility of being hurt. Because if I share myself with another person, I lay myself open to the possibility that he might stick a knife in me, an emotional knife. I lay myself open to the possibility that he may hurt me in a very real way. And I guess I don't want to be hurt anymore. But I'm learning through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and now I'm trying to build a bridge of outgoing love that reaches from me to God through you. And in the process of building the bridge, I've discovered that unless I'm willing to take a chance on being hurt, I'll be forever lonely. There's somebody sitting in here today who doesn't know that I learned a lot of this from her, but I did. She's a nurse out at the Georgian Clinic, and she's a great AA girl, too. Her name's Smitty, and I'm so glad to see her. Smitty tells it like it is, and I've heard her tell a lot of people the way it is. And just listening in on some of Smitty's conversations helped me to realize that, Art, if you don't tear down the prison, you may be safe, but you'll always be lonely. Our purpose says that there are no dues or fees for AA membership. And yet, you know, we all mention at one time or another in our lives the high price we had to pay in order to qualify for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to remind you that the price for continued sobriety, the price for learning to live a life that has meaning and purpose and direction, is also very, very dear. It means, among other things, giving the God of your understanding his full share of the credit for being the architect who drew up the master plan for your life and for mine. And it's hard to do for a guy like me. Man, I want the credit. I want him to have it. But unless he gets it, I, as the builder, build prisons instead of bridges. It means that I need to continually battle my greatest foe, and that is pride. Even when I least expected, the old pride rears his ugly head and he tries to take control of my life. So I have to constantly be on guard to try to fight the good fight with him. The price for continued sobriety, the price for meaningful life, is not cheap. It means the continuous acceptance of the fact that ultimately you and I are responsible for us. Nobody else is responsible for us. You and I are responsible for us. We talk a lot in AA about let go and let God. And I believe in this, the way I interpret it. For me, let go and let God does not mean that we can pass on to him the responsibility of what we do with the building blocks that he gives us. God didn't make any robots. He made you and he made me and he gave us a mind. He made us free and he gave us the responsibility to make choices and holds us responsible for the choices we make. Therefore, when you say let go and let God, this doesn't mean that you are abdicating the responsibility for your life. It means that every hour of every day, the final decision of whether or not to take that first drink has to be made within the loneliness of each individual soul. You can carry the chips with you from now till the cows come home. And you can make all the telephone calls you want. And you can drop by the club as often as you please. And you go to all the meetings that you wish. But the ultimate decision as to whether or not you're going to take the first drink is a decision that nobody can make but you. Clarence told me he didn't want any long-winded sermons up here today, so I'm giving you a short-winded one. And I'm going to close. I'm going to close with a story that describes or illustrates for me, better than anything else, what AA means to me. Some of you heard the story before because I use it often. It seems that in Europe, during World War II, as you know, a great many cathedrals were totally destroyed. And after the war was over, in this one little mountain village, the people looked at the ruins of their cathedral and they said, "We want to rebuild it again. We want it to be more beautiful than it has ever been before." And so, toward this end, they brought together all their material goods and sold everything of value that they had. And with the money that they received from this sale, they were able to employ an architect to draw the plans and a building contractor to begin the building of their new cathedral. And as the building contractor went about getting the necessary people he would need for his job, he found it wasn't too difficult to find brick masons. It wasn't too difficult to find carpenters and electricians. But search as far as he couldn't find enough stained glass artisans to do the job. What's a cathedral without stained glass windows? All over Europe his search took him, and finally he was able to find two qualified stained glass artisans, enough for him to at least begin, with the hope that as the work continued, somehow he would find the third one that he needed. And as he sat in his office one day, wondering about where in the world he would find this third stained glass artisan, there was a knock on his door. A man came in who was poorly dressed, who looked as though he hadn't had a shave for a few days, whose clothes were a little tattered. And the building contractor looked at him and said, "Yes, what do you want?" And the man smiled and he said, "I understand you're looking for a stained glass artisan." And the builder looked him up and down again and noticed his unkempt appearance and he said, "Yes, I am. Do you know where I can find one?" And the man said, "I'm a stained glass artisan." And the builder looked at him again and he sneered, "You? You're a stained glass artisan? What's your name?" And the man said, "My name isn't important, but I am a first-rate stained glass artisan." And he went on trying to describe his qualifications to this contractor. And finally, he said to the contractor in desperation, "Look, I know you don't believe that I'm really qualified, that I'm really all this skilled. But listen just a minute. Put me to work. Pay me no salary. Just give me a place to sleep and three meals to eat. And let me do the job. And after I've finished the job, if you like it, then you pay me the same that you're paying the other two stained glass artisans. If you're dissatisfied with my work, you don't owe me a thing." And the contractor thought about it for a few moments and ran through his mind again the fact that he had searched everywhere and this seemed to be the last possibility. And so he said, All right, on that basis, I'll give you a chance." And the man said, as he started to leave, "There's just one thing. I don't like people watching me while I work. I wonder if you could arrange to have a curtain drawn over the wall where my window will be so that I can work behind that curtain out of sight and people won't be bothering me." And the contractor thought, "Well, he's, you know, a little screwy, but that's all right. We'll arrange for that." So he had a curtain built across the wall, and the man came into work the next day. As he came into work, he stopped and he chatted for a few minutes with the other two stained glass artisans, and then he disappeared behind the curtain. And they could hear him pecking away during the day, and this went on day after day and week after week. Each day as he came to work, he would stop and he'd talk with the other two stained glass artisans for a few minutes. And then he would disappear behind the curtain, and they'd hear him chipping away throughout the day. And the weeks rolled into months, and the months passed, and finally the cathedral was ready for inspection by the people of the village. And they were called together and brought up to the cathedral to make the grand tour. And the building contractor was showing them around, and he started over on this side, and as he worked his way down, he pointed out the beautiful handwork that had gone into the building of the cathedral. And all the time that he's doing that, he's looking over his shoulder because this curtain is still drawn. And finally, just as they get around to the curtain, the artisan steps from behind the curtain and looked at the contractor, and he said, "My window's ready." The contractor took a deep breath because he didn't know what in the world the people were going to see. Up to now, everything had been perfect. And what if this man had blown it all? But he didn't have anything else to do but pull the cord. And he pulled the cord and the curtain slid back, and there before the eyes of the contractor and all the people was the most beautiful stained glass window that they'd ever seen. And they were so struck by its beauty that they just stood in awesome silence for a moment. And finally the contractor turned to the artisan and he said, "Who are you anyway?" And the artisan said, "I told you in the beginning, my name doesn't matter." And the contractor said, "Well, if you won't tell me who you are, would you at least tell me where you got the glass for this window? It's so far superior to the glass in the other two windows." And the man smiled and he said, "Yeah, I'll tell you that." He said, "You know, every morning when I came to work, I stopped by and I chatted with the other two artisans for a few moments. And while I stood there talking with them, I reached down into the trash cans and I picked up the broken fragments and the shattered pieces that they had discarded. And I carried them behind the curtain. And the window that you see before you now has been built from the discards and the thrown away broken shattered pieces of the other two." Well, it's just a story. But it's more than that for me. Because for me it says that the God of my understanding reached down and through you picked up the broken pieces of this life of Art Grand's and put it together in a far more beautiful way than old Art had ever been able to do by himself. And that's why I thank God for AA, for the fellowship, for the belonging to one another. And that's why I thank you for me. There are as many different roads to Alcoholics Anonymous as there are members in our fellowship. And yet every single road leads by a pig pen, because every alcoholic has to find, like the prodigal son, his own pig pen. And whether that pig pen happens to be in one of the fanciest, luxurious suites in Atlanta, or whether it happens to be in the ghetto area of Atlanta, it's still a pig pen. We all got here by way of the pig pen. Thank God for pig pens. Thank God most of all for the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, their strength, and their hope with each other. Now we can close this convention by simply saying, let's preserve the fellowship, and for that you and I are responsible. Thank you.